Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. In the following presentation, David Lee, CalCOS's Director of Prevention Services, interviews a team who wrote the white paper, The Use and Misuse of Data on Rape, Restoring Sexual Violence to the National Agenda.
Welcome. Today, I'm very excited to be able to have Jody Raphael from the DePaul College of Law and T.K. Logan from the University of Kentucky. Glad to have you here, Jody and T.K.
Oh, thank you.
I was really excited to be able to read your white paper and really talk about the issues of how rape statistics have been used and misused. And data is so important for us to be able to understand this work. And you talk about the context as well. So I'd like to hear more about your paper. In the paper, you had four sections. And TK, can you start with talking about what we know? What are some of the statistics and the data that we know about the prevalence of rape?
One of the best ways to know what the rape prevalence is, in our opinion, was looking at the latest Kilpatrick study, who actually went back. He did the first study in 1992 called Rape in America, and then he used the National Violence Against Women study, and then his most recent study that all used a similar definition, a similar methodology, and similar questions, and basically found a slight increase, although it wasn't significant, but looking in 1992, found about 13% of women reported rape with a very specific definition of forced penetration, about 15% in the National Violence Against Women survey, and about 16% in his most recent study. So we're not seeing a decline, as some studies come out and report. We're seeing basically a steady trend, but we're also seeing some lower numbers than what we see in some media, which I know we're going to get into a little bit later as well.
We're really trying to answer that question of how big of a problem rape is. And there's a lot of variables about how that can come out different. It might be what the study is asking.
It's even more basic than that. It is even looking at just what is the definition of rape. And, you know, you can pick up a paper and see one that asks, have you ever had unwanted sex? Which is honestly so general and really doesn't necessarily imply force, to another paper that defines it very narrowly to forced only penetration. And so then you're comparing these papers and you're like, well, how can this be possible? And there's a whole lot of stuff in between, I should say. So that's an issue. Your sample, if you're going to a shelter sample or a very specific clinical sample or group of adolescents that have run away from home, you're going to find much higher rates than a general population survey. You're right. When you look at prevalence rates, you really have to look, starting with the definition, most important piece, and then looking at the sample, and then looking at timing. I think this is another one that a lot of people really get confused about, is the time frame. How many people were raped in this past year, but they'll interpret it as lifetime or vice versa. When we were going through this paper, I was about to pull my hair out. The articles are not necessarily all clear. It is hard to dig through and find these details, but it's really important that you do that if you really want to understand. And that's part of the reason we really wanted to start our paper with this piece, is like, this is really important. This is your foundation. And then you've got to move toward the next steps, which is how do you counter the backlash that we're seeing?
That's helpful. I know I spend a lot of time trying to sort my way through the research and understand the difference between the prevalence and incidence and how we can be able to move forward, but yet that's important that we be able to do that. And I think that your paper actually gives a real nice, concise summary of the current research there around the prevalence of sexual assault. Jody, when we talk about the data, we often see there's two different ways. First, I want to talk about how some people misinterpret the data, and then we'll talk a little bit about what you term the rape denial campaign. How are some of the ways that people do misinterpret data?
The main way is the confusion that TK has already alluded to, and that is that most of this research is looking at lifetime. So when they ask people whether they have been ever subject to a rape, they're asking within their lifetime. That is most often then misinterpreted to say that this was a rape that occurred within the last year. People just cannot believe then, if we have 16% of women in the United States, according to the Kilpatrick studies, who have experienced forcible penetration within their lifetime, if you're then misinterpreting that to be within the last year, that just seems really high to a lot of people. And the problem is the confusion about the lifetime rates and the, within the last year. And the studies do differ. I think most of them do talk about lifetime. Now you see some where they're doing both lifetime and within the last year. And you see this especially on the college campus. A lot of the research is asking about lifetime, and then it's gotten misconstrued. And so you will see statements, X number of women, you're all going to be raped, you know, during your 4 years of college. Well, that's a lot different than a lifetime rate. And a lifetime rate will, of course, include childhood sexual assault. So lifetime is very, very important. I think the other major mistake that is made, and you find this often in the media, is reliance upon uniform crime reports. These are reports made to police, to the police department, and then reported to the FBI. So the headline will be "Rape is Down This Year," based on reports made to the police. And that is not prevalence. That's just reporting. That's a reporting statistic. And we know that the huge majority of cases are never reported to police. Actually, the majority of crime is not reported to the police. All different kinds of crime, rarely reported to the police. So to use a police report as evidence of prevalence is the other major mistake. And I think the problem is that the other problem is that the rape denial campaign it wants to say that we don't have a problem with rape in the United States for various political motives, which we may or may not have time to talk about on this conversation. But to say that rape is not a problem, then the deniers want to attack all of the statistics, and because of all the confusion and the misreporting of research, that just gives an open. It's an open field then. I mean, it makes it very easy for people that want to deny rape to then tear down all of these different reports because, you know, when they talk about them, they confuse them and they misconstrue them, and then we have just total anarchy in terms of what these statistics are. The other thing that TK and I have been not able to trace is you see a lot of rape victim advocates on their websites and on their brochures and so on, talking about 1 in 3 women will be subject, have been subject to rape. And we cannot trace this figure. There's no research report even that's out there that has a 1 in 3 figure. And I don't know where that came from or whether there was some report originally that was confused or whether there's some report that talks about 1 in 3 that's using a much broader definition, including all sorts of other sexual assault and sexual abuse, or just what it is. But the 1 in 3 statistic is not accurate and opens up rape victim advocates then to being attacked by the denial campaign.
I think I have seen this, and it appears, especially with the internet now, we have anyone can publish a statistic, and we can't overstate it, but yet we need to state, as TK talked about, we have really a vast body of research that shows very high rates, 1 in 3, you know, whether it's 1 in, you know, 18% or 16%, those are extremely high rates for lifetime prevalence still.
Well, it's very, very high. Well, I have talked with some rape victim advocates, and they think that doesn't sound high enough. You know, and so I don't know where that's set in, that we have to have a higher figure, that it would be, it's just too dangerous to go with this lower figure.
12.1 million American women, according to one report, but Kilpatrick did find, translated that higher. I just am not seeing that number.
18 million women, yeah.
There you go, yeah.
Using the 2005 census, this is going to be 18 million women who are living with the consequences of having been raped.
Right. So it's,
now that 18 million is that to me is a very high number. So I think again, it's very important to go from these percentages and then to go to the actual number of women. And since when was 18% a low figure? Well, you know, out of 100, it is, but it's a huge number.
Well, and the other thing that I think we forget to do is to contextualize these numbers in terms of, you know, how many women are affected by breast cancer. And right now the number is that about 12.1% will be affected by it. And then we're talking about 16% of women. I mean, and you know, this is a public health issue that causes all kinds of health problems and mental health problems. And to kind of contextualize the numbers that way, rather than looking and saying, oh, we need these numbers to be higher, which, as Jody said, invites the backlash then, because they're harder to defend. And also it just opens yourself up to all, they're hard to believe.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this backlash, what you call the rape denial campaign. Jody, can you explain a little bit about who these people are and what they're claiming?
I certainly can. I have been studying this for some years. Actually, I started when because this has gotten some renewed life with the Duke LaCrosse case in 2006, and I was reading some of the commentary about the case and began to pick up on this campaign. And basically, the campaign has two initiatives. One is to attack the statistics and to reap a lot of confusion about the statistics. And the second is to say that, okay, whatever these numbers are, 50% of these claims are false. So basically, they're saying the majority of women who come forward to report rape are lying about the rape claim. And this, you can see how this relates to the Duke LaCrosse case. And unfortunately, this has been a steady drumbeat of 50% of women lie about rape claims. And the media reputable publishers have published books about the Duke LaCrosse case, and the authors have put this forward, and there's been no fact-checking whatsoever. Research, very difficult, of course, when talking about false claims, very difficult, of course, to prove this through research, because there's a lot of cases in which we'll never really know if the claim was false or not, but false claim means someone is deliberately lying, and I suppose a false claim would be if a woman said she was an ex-spot and was raped, and it turns out that investigation shows she was in California at the time, for example. But you don't have a situation like that where there will be definite proof coming out to show that this is a false claim. And a false claim is not a case in which a credibility, where charges can't be brought, or where was not found guilty, or if the police do not feel it's credible, that's not a false claim. A false claim is that it is deliberately false, and we can prove that it is deliberately false. Somebody is really lying about the situation. But what this research that we do have, and we have 7 research studies which have really gone to try to determine what percent of cases in police files are false, we have a range of 2-7%. So we are nowhere close to the 50% mark. But this is a steady drumbeat, and a lot of people are now saying, 50% sounds kind of high. But there has been no response to this attack, to this false rape claim, and to these charges. And there really hasn't been any systematic response on the part of rape victim advocates, who I don't think know this new research about false rape claims. So these charges get repeated, and you say it often enough, it sounds like it is true. And what that then does, there's a sense of skepticism that comes across and will affect the police, will affect the prosecutors, judges, and juries, and even rape victims themselves are going around saying, well, was this really rape? So the false rape claims is, I think, a very serious situation, and I think that it's really, really started with the Duke LaCrosse case, and I don't think that the field has had a proper response to it, and I think the media has just totally bought into it. The other one, which I started with, is that and we've talked about it somewhat, is to attack the statistics. The attack here is mostly trying to attack the methodology and saying that these numbers that we're coming up with, 16% and so on, is based on an enlarged definition of rape, which includes, it's more than forcible penetration, which is not true. The rape studies that TK referenced all use a fairly narrow definition, and if there's other things they ask about, those have all been separated out very, very nicely. But this group is also wanting to attack the studies as not being reliable. But so those are the two.
And they tend to attack not just all studies, but they tend to attack really the first studies that were done and not all the subsequent studies.
Well, they also, yes, they don't, they do not reference, very interestingly, the rape denial industry does not reference any study since 1985. So they are not referencing any of the studies that we are talking about. And the media does not seek to, so they write articles and blogs and whatnot, but in these articles they're talking about this 1985 study, and the editor doesn't seek to ask, well, don't we have any more recent studies since 1985? And rape victim advocates, as TK mentioned, don't reference the new studies either. So we are really locked in a battle about a study from 1982, published in 1985, and none of the new data is coming into the discussion at all.
And can I just jump in here about another trend that this one is one that really bothers me a lot, and that is to use the statistics almost against, and so maybe even the backlash will say, oh, well, you know, it's a stranger rape where she was really beat up, and okay, that's real rape, but and not to look at the other statistics, that the vast majority of rapes, of women knew their attackers, for example, but because the line is fuzzier, that's easier to attack, and that's what where they're going to hit, or the substance-facilitated rapes, which is the statistics and the numbers are just, we're just now getting to understand that and to get some numbers out on that. But because I think it is newer and a little bit fuzzier, then we get a lot of victim blame kind of attacks on those two issues as well.
I think that's an excellent point, and I cannot emphasize it enough, is that if 80% or more rapes are people that you know are and happen in these social situations, then that's what rape is today. What's happened, I think, in the country is that, and once women have become sexually active and we have sexual liberation, then there isn't going to be, the public has not been able to accept that this is rape. And if you can't, so therefore rape is being kind of written out as a crime in the United States, since the bulk of it is going to take place in social situations, and it is going to involve women who have been who are sexually active, and so rape cannot be accepted by the public. So in these situations, so basically, they just think these are very fuzzy claims. Am I making sense? Is that
right? Well, I think so. So it really leads to, I think, my next question, and poses to you, TK, is what are the steps that we need to be able to take to be able to address this? And that, those of us who am in the Prevent Connect community, we have thousands of people who are doing rape prevention and dating violence prevention work. So what are some of, from based on the research that you've done, you see are the important steps that we need to address in our doing our prevention work?
Being really careful about what statistics are used, being more conservative but strong and solid in those statistics as opposed to exaggerating, and publicizing the new studies that are out. That's number one for me. Jody?
I think that's right, but I think that in terms of prevention, yes, we have 18 million who have been subject, but basically the 16% says that most men are not rapists. All men are not rapists. Most men are not potential rapists. By ending the exaggeration, and let's hone in on the rapists that we have. So it's a subset of all men, and we need to understand more about who these people are. They're probably repeat predatory offenders. What is motivating them? So in order to prevent it, I think we have to get our arms around, as TK said, the actual number, and we need to know more then about this smaller subset of men. If we go running around with these numbers that are way too high, then we've got such a problem with men that we may as well just throw up our hands.
I mean, I think the second thing is to educate young women about what the numbers are, that yes, stranger rape does happen, but it's more likely to be someone you know, and to talk more about how that can happen. It just seems a lot scarier and a lot easier to think about protecting yourself from the stranger rape and all of the cognitive things that go on in social situations that make it very difficult to protect yourself. And I'm not just talking about drinking. I'm talking about the cognitive cues. So you focus on having fun or you would like to have a relationship, and then it kind of lets down your guard about the fact that you're likely to be attacked by someone you know.
And I think we cannot buy into the view of date rape, which the rape denial industry has, which is that it's the girl's fault equally, or there's equally at fault, and there's alcohol involved here, and, you know, and the whole thing gets very, very blurry. I think that we have to say that I don't care how much alcohol is being drunk, and I don't care how well these people know each other. Rape is rape, that somebody is attacking somebody else, and probably somewhat violently. So I think we have to be more graphic about what is going on in these situations. And that means that the victims and the victim advocates have to be much more graphic and speak out about the circumstances and what happened. And I think we've been really reticent to do that. So I think we give people the idea this is just bad sex or something that wasn't pleasurable to one party. But I think we have something else that's going on here. I think we need to redefine that and talk about that in a much different way. We have to start putting out the information that we have.
And there's opportunities that we need to be able to take advantage of. So, for example, the Centers for Disease Control is now collecting evidence for its National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Surveillance System. When their findings come out there, that gives us another opportunity to be able to highlight the prevalence and to be able to highlight the messages that are important and then be able to focus on how we can be able to prevent this issue.
I think Americans really love statistics, and I think that the rape crisis community has really been too simplistic and has not really briefed itself enough. I mean, and I certainly didn't until, say, several years ago either. We just really have to understand these statistics and use them.
Thank you so much. We will have a link to the article. It's available at no cost on the Prevent Connect website. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.